the previous tape ran out on us as we were reading, so I'm going to review once more. Okay, we are on Tes Zion Umid Beis, in other words, 16b. Okay, and we are roughly seven lines from the bottom.
Seven
bodies from the bottom. Okay? All right.
I see it.
Okay. The question that was raised, and this was the last thing that we concluded with, you know, last week, was why does it say in the last pasuk of the Megillah that Mordechai was great among the Jews, but also v'ratzui l'rovecha, which means that he was looked with favor upon by the majority of his brethren. So the question is, why the majority? Why not say by all Jews? So the answer is, that they give, is that So Malame, it says, his teachers are Shepershim ben Mitzah Sanhedrin. That some of the members of the Sanhedrin turned aside from Mordechai. They didn't want to have anything more to do. Okay? And why? So Omer Rav Yosef, so Rav Yosef said, Godol Talmud Torah, okay, it says that the study of Torah is even greater than saving lives. The miyakora, because to begin with, choshev, we find the following, choshev lei le Mordechai, we find that there's a verse which counts Mordechai, or which mentions Mordechai, boso dalet, after four other names, delif sof, and then in a later one, what do we find? Boso Chamisha, we find that he is listed after five, and they bring the Pesukim down. It says Mei Korah, to begin with, in other words, in the earlier Pasuk, which happens to be in the book of Ezra, right? So it's written Ksiv Asher Bo'u Im Zerubbabel, people who came together with Zerubbabel from, of course, Babylonia to Eretz Yisrael in order to rebuild the land. So you have Yeshua, that's number one. Nehemiah is two. Sariah is three. Re'aliah is four, right? And then who's number five over there? Mordechai. Okay, so it follows four other names, okay? And then Bilshan. Some say that Mordechai and Bilshan are the same, but that Bilshan. Either he's a guy, or according to another drash, it's really Mordechai. And why is he called Bilshan? Because he knew 70 different languages. Remember, this goes back again to another thing that we read in the Megillah, namely, how did Mordechai understand the two Shomrei Hasaf, you know, Bixen and Teresh, when they were talking in the language of the Tarsiyim, okay? But the answer is that he knew the language, because as a member of the Sanhedrin, he had to be fluent in 70 different languages. Tarsian. The language of Tarsus or something like that. Today Tarsus is part of Turkey and Greece and so on, you know. But in those days, you know, who knows what they were talking over there. Okay.
Tarsus is Cyprus.
No, Caprician is Cyprus. Yeah. No, there are some who identify Tarshish with Spain. This is true. There are many who say that it really represents Spain, and this became a very current theory, you know, that in other words, it represented the two ends of the Mediterranean. Eretz Israel is at one end, at the eastern end, and of course Spain is at the other end. So therefore they said that on the Yos Tarshish, ships that not only went, let's say, up to Asia Minor, according to some, but actually that they were seaworthy ships that they could go across the entire Mediterranean as far as Spain. And of course we know that the Phoenicians, people from Tzor, Sidon, you know, the Phoenicians over there, and they were sort of related to the Jews by language and so on, and also by treaties, if you remember, Hiram el Tzor, you know, Hiram the king of Tyre made an agreement with Shlomo HaMelech so that they helped to build the Beis HaMikdash, They cut the timber in Lebanon, and they shipped it as rafts down the coast to Yafo, and then we slept overland to Yerushalayim. Of course, if you travel the area, you know that going up to Yerushalayim is not an easy thing. Yeah.
Well, why is it important to establish a pegging order?
Why is there important to establish?
Yeah, okay. When he comes by with six.
All right, I want to show you. All right. This is what they say. Okay? We said that he followed four in this pasuk, right? Then they quote another pasuk taken from Nehemiah. Lifsof, finally, it's written, Haboyim im Zerubbabel. Who are the people who came with Zerubbabel? Yeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Rahamiah, Nachmani, Mordechai. And Bilshan. All right. So now, where is he listed? He's listed after five. Okay.
He's number six.
Huh?
He's number six.
Yeah, he's number six, but he follows five other people who preceded him. Therefore, the pecking order shows that they gave him a demotion. Instead of being the fifth in line, they made him the sixth in line. Among the dignitaries who came back with Zerubbabel, important people came back with Zerubbabel. In order to rebuild Eretz Yisrael. Okay? So, this is what they're saying.
Who established this order?
Who established this order?
I mean, who claims that this one is better than the other?
There are two psukim. One of them is at Ezra, where they listed people, the important people who came back, and the other one is Nehemiah, where they list again, you know, people who came back.
I understand Yeshua.
All right. Yeah, this has nothing to do with you know who. Yeshua. Yeshua actually was probably the high priest, because the reason is we have in the prophet Zechariah, those of you who are familiar with the Haftorah, you know, either Baal Esau or Shabbos Chanukah, right? That he has the vision of Yeshua, Kohen HaGadol, right? Joshua, the high priest, and he's standing there in tatters and everything else, and Zechariah tells him, you know, the time has come, you know, that he should wear the robes of glory again. In other words, he's shown that the Beis HaMikdash will once more flourish, even as in its earlier days, you know, back in the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, and then he has his vision of the oil feeding the menorah. So, and of course, that's the reason why we read it on that occasion. All right. So, to get back to the point, they're saying, okay, you see, that in the estimation of Ezra and Nehemiah, that's where it comes from, right. So, we see in the estimation of Nehemiah, he was demoted, which shows that some of the people who were, after all, the great dignitaries, and we also say, you know, what did these people do when they came back? They established what they called the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah. You understand? Or, if you wish, they were the first Sanhedrin after the reconstruction of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? So we see, according to this, that not everybody was happy with Mordechai. Why not? Because they say that Mordechai neglected Talmud Torah in the quest, as we would say, for Hatzolos Nefoshos. What is Hatzolos Nefoshos? Well, obviously, there are times when you have to be Matzil Nefesh, when you have to save a life, and that takes precedence over anything else. But the point is, at this particular point, the Jews had finally been saved from destruction. You understand? They had been saved. So therefore, they felt that Eibazay, instead of remaining a politician at the court of the king, Mordechai should have returned again to the study of Torah and the teaching of Torah. Now, this is a job that he should have continued. So this is the reason why some of the people in Sanhedrin they literally departed from him. In other words, they separated themselves from him.
I would be an attorney for the defense here, for Mordechai.
Yeah,
I can think
it's
of
all right.
Many reasons why he would think that would be the place to be.
Yeah.
Not trusting
Achashverus, right. Maybe another Haman would arise. I can understand that. Right.
So that he felt that he was the watch person
right.
Of a situation, and that this would be the best place to be was in the palace.
Right.
And
look, I'm not so inclined to favor Mordechai, but I'm telling you what the feeling is over here, which is expressed in the Gemara, that having saved them, he should have devoted more time against this Torah instead of engaged in the politics of the royal court. Okay?
But no.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The books of Ezra and Nehemiah, did they attain sanctity in their lifetime?
Well, you ask a difficult question. I'll tell you why. They wrote their books, right? And, you know, people began to study their works, et cetera, et cetera. But that leads us to a different question, and that's the question, at what point in history did they finally come together and, as we would say, canonize the Bible? In other words, to establish that this is what the Bible is, and so on. So, according to Gemara and Baba Basra, actually it happened after the destruction of the first temple. I mean, after the destruction of the second temple. But, needless to say, the sanctity had already existed for thousands of years, even before that. In other words, the Torah, you know, they're always quoting Torah, they're always quoting Proverbs, and then Psalms, and so on and so forth, and referring always to the history, you know, to Shmuel, and to this, and that, and so on and so forth. So, actually, these were already accepted, but the question is only at what time was it made officially part of the text. And now, as I say, this was done after the destruction of the Second Temple, when they decided once and for all, we must have a clearly defined Bible to know which books we consider Sifrei Kodesh, as holy writings, or Kisvei Kodesh, right, and which books, which may be very nice, but at the same time we cannot feel that they have the same divine inspiration and therefore cannot be included in the official text of the Bible. A couple of examples of those, but there are others, but I'll give you just two of them. One of them is the books of the Maccabees. I mean, what do we know about Hanukkah? We know very little from the Gemara itself, except, you know, one has to say why we light the Hanukkah lights and how we observe it, okay? And that's just very simply, you know, that when the Hasmonean dynasty was able to conquer the Greeks, you know, and restore, and so you know, this miracle happened, and that's why we celebrate Hanukkah, okay? But the whole story about how, for example, Yehuda Maccabi and his father Matisyahu and so on and so forth, that primarily we get from the books of the Maccabees. Now what happened with the books of the Maccabees? They were never accepted as part of the Bible, and they might have been lost to us if it weren't for the fact that the Christian church, particularly the Catholics, decided to include it in their Bible. To this collection of books, we call them the Apocrypha, which means literally, you know, hidden writings, okay? So, another example would be Ben Sira. Gemara will quote occasionally Ben Sira, because he was the author of the Book of Wisdom, and many of the Proverbs, you know, sound like something that came from the Proverbs of Solomon and so on. So there was, you know, a great deal of feeling, people quoted him and so on, but they felt that it did not have the same Ruach HaKodesh as the Book of Mishlei, the Book of Proverbs in the Bible. They debated about some of the others. They debated about Esther, whether to include it or not. So therefore, we have the statement that we learned some time ago, that Esther pleads with the sages, Kvouni Ladoros, please make a record for me and establish me that I may be remembered throughout the generations for what, you know, what happened over here. Okay, so they decided, okay, we'll make the Book of Esther part of it. The Book of Kohelet, there was a question as to whether to accept it. You know, it's a very at times it's very pessimistic, at times it There are verses in it that seem to contradict one another, and so, but finally they decided that it also is Ruach HaKodesh, okay?
What about Job? I'm always curious about Job, how that came to be.
Okay. So the answer is that they finally decided to accept the book of Job as well. Yes, right. Another book that they had some hesitation about was Yechezkel. Book of Yechezkel. Why? Because, for example, in one chapter, he gives laws for the kohuna, for the kohen, that are stricter even than what we find in the Torah. Torah, for example, says that an ordinary kohen cannot marry a gerusha, a divorcee, right? But he can't marry an almana. Okay? Just the Kohen Gadol is prohibited from marrying an almana or a gerusha. He can only marry a virgin. That's what's written. Okay? Along comes Yechezkel, and he says that the Kohen may not marry an almana except the almana of the Kohen. So, okay, that being the case, fine, that's Yechezkel's point of view, but they decided, we'll overlook that, okay? We go by the Torah, we don't go by the prophets, okay? So this is the basic reason, I mean, why they finally decided to accept it. So this is the story, okay? All right. Now, to continue over here, the Yitemah, and there are those who say, Omar Rav, did I leave something out? Omar Rav, Rav said, the Yitema Rav Shmuel Bar Matar. Some say it wasn't Rav, but it was Rav Shmuel Bar Matar who said the following. He said, Godol Talmud Torah, Yosem Ibinyan Beis HaMikdash. He says, the study of Torah is even more important than the building of the Beis HaMikdash. What does he basically say? Shekol's man shebarach v'neiriyo kayom lo hinicho Ezra. The Ola says, as long as Baruch ben Neiriyo, who happened to be disciple and also the secretary of the prophet Yirmiyahu, as long as he was alive, Zerubbabel remained where? He remained in Babylonia. He would not leave over there. Ezra did not leave him, okay? Ezra learned from Baruch ben Neriyo, and Ezra refused to go to Eretz Israel as long as Baruch ben Neriyo was still alive, because he wanted to learn Torah. Afterwards, when Baruch ben Neriyo had passed away, this is when Ezra then went back to Eretz Israel in order to rebuild it. So from this we see then that the study of Torah is even greater than the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Of course, I mean, let's face it, in historical perspective, we always pray for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Nevertheless, what are we to do? Sit around idly in the meantime? Obviously not. What we have to do is to learn Torah and keep alive the flame of Judaism, you see. And this is what has happened all this time. So that from this particular point of view, we can understand why this statement was made. Okay.
Doctor,
yes?
This is kind of a trivial question. Baruch ben Neriyo was the secretary for Yirmiyahu. We know
right,
this because
right.
He brought out the deed for Anatol.
Right.
I thought Yirmiyahu went to Egypt.
Okay. He was dragged to Egypt, yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Baruch ben Neriyo then went from Egypt to Babel, is that it?
Well, he could have gone with those who were exiled to Babylonia to begin with.
Ah, I see. Okay, so they separated. Okay,
right, they separated.
Okay,
This is what I would have to assume. Okay. Omar Rabba, Omar Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Shmuel. Okay, Bar Shmuel, Bar Barta. Okay, all right. So, Rabba said in the name of Yitzchak, the son of Shmuel, the son of Marta. Okay. Godol Talmud Torah, Yosem Kibbut Avaim. He says, you know what? The study of Torah is even more important than the mitzvah of honoring your father and your mother. How does he base it? So he bases it, as we'll see, upon psukim that we have in Sefer Bereishis. He says, Shekol Oysen Shonim, all those years, Shehoya Yaakov Avinu Veis Eiver, that Yaakov was in the Beis Medrash of Eiver. I mean, we have a tradition in the Midrashim that Yaakov Avinu learned Torah in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever. Okay? So Ever was his teacher, and he had an early yeshiva, so to speak, right? And Yaakov Avinu went and he studied over there for many, many years. Now, Lo Ne'enash, he was not punished. He was not punished for what? He was not punished for the fact that he did not come back to his father and mother and show them the respect and so on. Instead, he remained as a yeshiva bacher, learning all those years. But nevertheless, he was not punished for it because he was engaged in what mitzvah? The mitzvah of learning Torah, Talmud Torah. Okay?
His mother sent him away.
Of course,
his mother's instruction.
Absolutely, absolutely.
His mother.
Right, but you know, according to the Midrash, she sent him away, and he should have gone directly where to Lavan, right? And then go to find a wife. You understand? But he didn't. Instead, what did he do? He went to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever and he studied over there, and then first he set out in order to go to Arab Naharaim, in order to find a wife. Okay? All right. The Omar Bar, as we have a tradition of one of the rabbis who said, and now we have to get out the next page. Okay? No?
That's how I understand that he deviated. Actually
it says that he listened to his parents and went to Baran Arab. This is what it does say.
This is a
harkin or this is a chocolate? Okay. The Umar. So tradition says that we are now on Yud Zayin Omid Aleph, going down the home stretch in this first perk. It says, Lobo Nimnu Shnoisav Shal Yishmuel. It says, why do we find in the Torah how long Yishmael lived? Do we really need to find out how long Yishmael lived? But the answer is, from reading what it has to say about that, it's Kidei Le'yachez Vahen Shnoisav Shel Yaakov. It's in order for us to be able to establish, you know, to relate literally, I mean, you know, Yachas, Yichus, etc., to relate how many years did Yaakov live, and also, you know, what was the chronology in his life? This is, as the pasuk says, "Ve'ele shnei chaye Yishmael," right? And these are the years in the life of Yishmael. Me'as shonor, right? 100 years, v'shloshim shonor, and 30 years, v'sheva shonim. All right. In other words, he lived 137 years. Okay. So they say, Kamo Koshish Yishmael mi Yitzchak. How much older was Yishmael than Yitzchak? Don't forget, they came from the same father, right? Who was the father of Yishmael and Yitzchak? Abraham Avinu, of course. Okay, but Yishmael was born earlier. So how many years difference were there? So the answer is, Arbeso Shonim. We find, as we read carefully the text of the Chumash, that it says that Yitzchak was 14 years younger than Yishmael. Okay? Dichsiv, and they now quote the pasuk which shows that. It's written, V'Avram ben Shmonim Shona, right? V'Shei Shonim, V'Lenis Hogeret Yishmael Yavram. It says that Abram was
86
years old at the time when Hagar gave birth to Yishmael. Yeah. Okay.
It was
100 hours. Unto Abram. Right. Okay. Yeah, he was good. He was good until even to old age. Yeah. All right. Ufsiv, and then we have another pasuk wants to say, says we Abraham ben Ashonor, right? Abraham was 100 years old. The evolved lawyer Yitzchak Bedo, when his son Yitzchak was born unto him. All right. So, if he was 86 at the time when Yishmael was born, right? And 100 at the time when Yitzchak was born, so we see that already Yishmael is 14 years older. So that gives us one point of reference. Uksiv, and then we have another pasuk. What does the pasuk say? It says, Yitzchak ben Shishim Shonu, but let us say something. Okay? Yitzchak was 60 years old when Rivka gave birth to the twins. In other words, to Yaakov and Esau. Okay? Bar Kama Havi Yishmael. So how old was Yishmael? Kiddush Yalid Yaakov, when Yaakov was born, right? So the answer is he had to be Bar Shivim Yarbov, right? He had to be 74 years old at this point. Okay? We do the arithmetic, we come to that. Then, Kama Paishan Mishanei, and so the question is, alright, so how much is left over from his life? So, Shisin is lost. So in other words, if you figure the life of Yishmael, there's still another 63 years for him to go before he passed away. V'tanya, and we have learned, Hoya Yaakov Avinu, let's see, V'tanya, right. Hoya Yaakov Avinu b'shorosh nizborech mi'aviv, that when Yaakov Avinu received a blessing from his father, remember that was before he left, right? He was ben shishim b'sholosh shana. He was 63 years old at that time, right? And at that very moment, so, Meis Yishmael. Yishmael died. How do we know that? Dirsiv, because it's written in the same parsha over there, it's written, Vayare Sov, Ki Verach Yitzchokes, that Esav saw that, you know, his father had blessed Yaakov, right? And he assumed that part of the reason why the blessing went to Yaakov and not to him, not to Esau, was because he had married what kind of women? Canaanite women, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah. So, therefore, it's written then, at that particular point, Vayelach Esav el Yishmael. So Esav went to Yishmael. Vayikach es machalas bas Yishmael achos de voyos. And he married Machalas, the daughter of Yishmael, the sister of Nevoyos. So it says, Mashba Shanemar Bas Yishmael. Since it already says that she was the daughter of Yishmael, Eini Yodea Shehi Achos Nevoyos, so don't I know from this that she had to be the sister of Nevoyos? So why then does it mention specifically that she was the sister of Nevoyos? Why did the Torah have to tell us that? So it says, Malamed, it teaches us, Shekitsha Yishmael Umeis, that Yishmael betrothed her to Esav, and then he died. Okay? Ve'siya Nevoyos Achiha. And instead, who was the one who married her off? It was Nevoyos, who was her brother. Okay. So, how many years do we now have? So it says, Shisin is lost, right? There are 64, okay? 63, excuse me. They are Besar, Adam, Yisrael, and Yosef. Now, another number of years passed until the time that what? That Yosef was born, right? So, Ha, Shivin, Veshiva. So, if we add up the numbers so far, we come to 77. Uksiv, and it's written, the Yosef ben Shloshim Shona b'yom nefnei Paro, that Joseph was 30 years old when he stood in the presence of Pharaoh. You know, in other words, Pharaoh had taken him out of prison and made him, you know, his Mishnah Lamel, right? So, Ho Me'a V'sheva. So, now that brings up the total to what? To 107. Okay? Shev, then we have what? Then we have Shev the Sova. Now we have to add that there were 7 years of plenty.
7 years.
Yeah, Vitarte the Kafta, and 2 years of hunger, because, you know, Yaakov sent to the right in order to get food, all right? So the 2 years passed, okay. So, Ha Meyo Vishisa. So we now come to 116. Uksiv, then we find written further, Vayomer Paro Yaakov, that Pharaoh said to Yaakov, Kami Yemei Shnei Chayecha, how old are you? How many years have you been alive? So, Vayomer Yaakov, and Yaakov said, El Paro, you know, to Pharaoh, he says, Yemei Shnei Megurai Shnoshim Ashana. He says, my life so far, literally the years of my sojourning upon the earth, are 130 years, right? So, now what does it bring us? It brings us to Meir Vishitza. So, Meir Vishitza Aliyah. So he says, that brings us, what? To 116. Elish Mamino, so from this we learn what? That Arba Esrei Shanin, Dalet Beis Eber, Loi Chashiv Lehu. The Bible doesn't reckon, it doesn't mention the 14 years that he was learning in the yeshiva of Eber. The Tanya, as we have learned, Oya Yaakov Beis Eber, that Yaakov was in the school of Eber, Mutman, hiding over there, in other words, he was not out in public, right? And how long was he there?
24 years.
Arba Esrei Shana. No, 14 years. Okay,
years.
Right. And then it says Aver Meis.
That's the 14 years.
Right, the 14 years that were not mentioned then are the 14 years that he spent in the yeshiva of Shemba Aver. Okay, and it says right, Aver Meis. Eber died, Yaakov Avinu, Arab Darayim, after Yaakov Avinu went to Arab Darayim in order to find, a wife, and it was Shtei Shadim, right? It was 2 years. Yatzav Isham, in other words, he's saying that from the time that he left the academy of Shem Eber, it took him still another 2 years in order to get to Arab Naharaim. Of course, when we read the Torah itself, it seems, Vayisa Yaakov Raglov, Jacob, you literally lifted his feet, right, and then came to Paran Aram, okay?
Oh, it's not that though. I mean, actually, when you read this, it begins to, you can visualize.
Yeah.
You're right. When you read the parsha, you don't see it. But when you read
this,
you can see here he's sort of wandering. It makes sense. He stopped in a place, put his head down, whatever.
Yeah. Right.
Well, anyhow, maybe I'm just imagining
things. He stopped off for 14 years.
This is very interesting.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so now that we've established that, right. Well, right. And
no,
then,
excuse me, 14 years makes there's another connection line, because it was 7 years for Rachel, Aaliyah, and 7 years for Rachel.
That's correct. It's another 14 years, absolutely right. Correct, right. So Nimsa, we find as follows.
14 years in the yeshiva.
Right, we understand.
But there's another, David didn't understand.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know, I found, but he also worked like, another 6 years or something?
He worked another 6 years, correct.
So it's like 20
right.
That he
right, so actually he spent, six,
years,
he spent 20 years there. Yeah. Right. So Nimsa we find then, Kishe Omad al Habe'er, that when Jacob stood by the well of water, where he lifted up the stone from it and he gave water, to all of Rachel's flock that she had brought over there. So he was already at that particular point Ben Shivim Misheva Shona, right? He was already 77 years old at that particular time. So, with all this figuring, now we come back to the point that we started with. He says, and how do we know the Lo Mayanash, that he was not punished for what? For spending those 14 years in the yeshiva and not communicating with his parents. He says, Netanya, as we've learned, Nimsa Yosef Sheperash Mi Oviv Esrim Lishtayim. Okay? We find that a similar thing happened in the case of Yosef. He was gone from his father 22 years, right? Esrim Lishtayim Shona, right? And Keshem Shepirash Yaakov Avinu Mi Oviv. Just as Yaakov, our father Yaakov, also was absent from his father. And the Yaakov, because in the case of Yaakov, what do we say? Glossin, the Shisa, Hadain, the 36 years, Havyad, were, Ela, Arbaeser, Havyad, the Vase, Ever, Lechashiv, Lehu. So, but the 14 years that he was in the Academy of Ever, they're not even counted in the Torah. So, finally, he says, the Vais Lovan Esrin Shonov, right? He was in the at the home of Lavan, as we said before, right? 20 years, as in Shona Hadion, right? Ella, Mishum, the Ishtache, Be'urcha, but we still have to account for the fact that he didn't immediately go home either. After he left, it still took him time in order to get back to his father's home. Mishum Nishtachu Be'urcha, because he tarried on the way, Tatin Shanim, 2 years. The Tanya, as we have learned, Yotzo Me'aram Naharayim, right? When, after he left Aram Naharayim, so it says, Volalo Zusukos, he came to Sukkos, right? And then the Otso Shom Shmona Sechodesh. And there he spent 18 months, in other words, year and a half. Shenemar, as it says, for Yaakov Nasar Sukkoso, by even low bias, will make Nehu Otso Sukkos, right? That Yaakov traveled to Sukkos. He built a house over there, and obviously it takes time to build a house. And then he also had to make sukkahs in order to protect his cattle. So in other words, it's already at least a year and a half since the time that he left. With a Veysel, and then he came to Veysel on the way home, and also Shisha Chodoshim, right? And he spent 6 months over there. The Hikrim Zavachim, and he offered up sacrifices. So from this we see that Yaakov Avinu actually took 2 more years yet to get home. But during the years that he learned Torah, he was not punished, and therefore that gets back to what the point that they started with, namely, that great is the study of Torah, right? God of Talmud Torah, right? You're sending Kibbutz off the aim. It's even more important than the respect shown to father and mother. Well, that's what it says.
But what about Shechem here? They don't, was Sukkot near Shechem? I mean, this whole, that obviously
it happened,
right. A few minutes.
That's correct. It happened while it was over there.
Yeah. In Sukkot, okay.
But they're not mentioning it over here. Here it doesn't play an important part of the narrative, okay?
Did I hear you correctly? Are you telling me that when he first approached for a wife, he was 76 years old?
77. Yeah.
And
it was an Alter Bocher.
And after that, he had how many wives and all these children?
That's right. Yeah. He was creative, but
he was prolific. The question is, how old was Lavan at this time? He must have been about, you know, half the age of Methuselah. I mean, it's difficult.
He is. Yeah, it's very hard to even imagine.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember. It's mentioned at the end of Parsha Vayera, over there, you know. After the story about the Akedah, that's right, you know, and then they heard the news that Milka is also giving birth to children to your brother Nocha, right? And so it's Bechorez, Bezochiev, Yeskimilavia, etc., okay? And finally, you know, it comes on, right. So then, finally it concludes, you know, that it was the father of Rivka, okay?
Yes,
so,
sure.
Okay. So we see, you know, that. You can draw a parallel over here, okay? The Bible doesn't really, conclude as to how old Lavan was, okay? But he was Lavan, the son of Bethuel. Bethuel was the one who was born at the time after the Akedah took place, okay?
Sure. No, I mean, we see this.
All right, so this is what happened.
Probably
Right. Okay, with this we come to the conclusion of the first parak. Hadron Aloch, Megillah Nikreis, and we say, Megillah Nikreis, this chapter, we hope to get back to you again someday. And I'll tell you, if you take the tapes. Yes, ma'am. Alright, tonight is the 13th of the month of March, the year 2002. Tonight is Rosh Chodesh Nissan. And I don't have to tell you that the Pesach is beginning to breathe down our necks. We will have a session next Wednesday night in Yitzhak Hashem, and then we'll take a break for 3 weeks, because it's going to be Yontif, and then I'll be back from Israel, I hope, by then. But if I know myself, I'll be too pooped to come immediately after my packing. We're supposed to leave a week from this Sunday, leave for New York, and then we have an early flight on Monday morning out of JFK. You know, these days it's a pain in the neck. They want you to be there 3 hours before. So we have an 8 o'clock. We have to be there not later than 8 o'clock in the morning.
When I went to Florida, yeah. It's an hour and a half. And let me tell you something. Yeah. He didn't check my
bag. Yeah. But I'll tell you, with El Al, anyway, they've always been much more careful than that.
Well,
so,
the government is taking over. And I understand at the end of November, every airport in the United States is going to have, they're really going to search.
Okay, so now we start this evening the second perek, second chapter in Maseches Megillah. It's called Akori Es HaMegillah, the person who reads the Megillah, the Mafreya. All right, so let's take a look at our Mishnah and see exactly what it says. First of all, the word Lamafreya means a good introduction by itself. Because in modern Hebrew, the mafreya means to begin with. But here in the Gemara, and also the same thing in Maseches Brachos, where there's a similar thing. Good evening, Saul. How are you? The word lamafreya has a different meaning. Lamafreya means in a mixed up order. If you're looking for a similar root, you have the word korua in Hebrew, which means you know, that the, like, for example, the air is let loose or something. In other words, disorderly, you understand? And therefore we have another word, ra'ot, which means all kinds of riots and things like that and so on, okay? So the mafreya over here then means in a disorderly fashion, okay? Meaning what? Well, for, let's say, you know, after all, the Megillah has, you know, 10 chapters in it. Let's say that the guy decided to start it to read chapter 3, where we are introduced to Haman officially, right? And then he decides, oh, wait a minute, well, I'll go back and I'll read, let's say, chapter 2, or I'll read chapter 1, whatever it may be. So if you read in this fashion, in a mixed up way, then in that particular case, the Mishnah says, Lo Yetza, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah of reading the Megillah properly. Okay? To read the Megillah, it requires a proper intention to do it in the order in which it is meant to be read.
It's interesting because I know in Reform
synagogues,
and I almost thought I remembered this, that in recent years, places like Temple Bethel, they're reading it in order, but I'm not sure they read every word. I mean, they didn't read the complete.
Oh, they didn't read a complete text?
I think so.
And in that case, Lo Yetza, they have not fulfilled the obligation.
Text, but I thought that they were saying it to speed it up, or so the kids wouldn't get bored, because for the first two parents,
you've got to every single word.
Correct.
And in order.
Yeah. Right, and in the right order, that's correct. This is exactly what this phrase is saying.
You said
how
one third of it.
Yeah, you're talking about the cycle of readings that they have, right.
Same thing with the
Yeah, this is what he's referring to.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Megillah.
Right.
She was, but then
right.
He said, oh,
right.
Sorry.
From there, right, Greg went into the Torah cycle that they have over there, right. I imagine that B'nai Jacob, too, I don't think they read a complete
is
center.
Is there any halakhic justification that they chose the deviate from acceptable?
It's a misreading of the halacha, okay? Let me explain. Once upon a time, there were two different systems of doing it. One was a system in Babylonia, which was to begin with Bereshis, to begin, you know, after the Sukkot holidays were over, and, you know, to complete it, you know, during the course of the year. This is the custom, that, of course, that we follow to this day, okay? In Eretz Yisrael, in ancient times, now I'm talking about, you know, about 2,000 years ago, maybe 1,900 years ago or something like that, there they had a different system. They had what they called the triennial cycle. But what did they do? Okay, let's say that they started with Bereshis, and they read, let's say, maybe a chapter and a half, two chapters, three chapters, whatever it may be. the following Shabbos, they continue from where they had left off. Then the following Shabbos, they would continue from where they had left off the previous week, and so on. In other words, they did not go skipping around. When the Reform decided to do it, so they decided, okay, we'll read a couple of verses each Shabbos of the particular, you know, the Parshas HaShavua. The conservative then decided that they do exactly the same thing, only they wanted to make it look, you know, more in accordance with tradition. So they had different people who came up with different ideas as to what a triennial cycle would be. But as I say, it's not the halachic one. Because what did they do? Let's say that the first time, let's say they'll read Bereishis, a couple of chapters. They'll read Noach the following week, a couple of chapters. Let's say Lech Lecha the following week, a couple of chapters. And then the next time around, you know, maybe in a year or something like that, so then they'll read a couple of more chapters, and then and so they work it that way. So what they call triennial cycle is really not exactly what was the custom of Eretz Yisrael, which was a perfectly halachic system.
It took them 3 years to read the Chumash, that's what you're saying.
Yeah, right, right.
So maybe the
right.
First year they got Bereishis and maybe part of them.
Yeah, correct, right.
Right. Reading it in order, so you get a sense of the, all of what...
You know, there are scholars who tried to figure out exactly how did they cut it up, you know, how did they cut up the various parts to know when they would read this, when they would read this, and so on and so forth. And it's based, of course, on the system of what we have, you know, where if you take a look in the text of the Torah, you know that some of them, they end... You know, let's say over here, and then the rest of the line is left empty. This is where you find in the Chumash it's marked by a pay, which means that psucha, literally, in other words, the rest of the line is open. And then you may have, you know, like for example, over here, okay, then a space over here, and then they continue over here. And that is what they call stuma. In other words, that that empty space is hemmed in on both sides. But both of them, I mean both the whether it was the pay or the samach, but at any rate it marked like a different subject matter. Okay? Sometimes it could consist of only one or two verses, but at other times it could go on and on and on and on and on without a break at all in the text. Okay? But this was the system that formed the basis of the triennial cycle back in the old days. Okay? And I don't have to tell you that Eretz Israel today does not follow that custom. Instead, they do what the rest of the world does. That they read whole sentences exactly the way everybody else does. Occasionally, they're ahead of us because, for example, this year wouldn't affect us, but the Shavuos this year, second day is Shabbos. They'll be reading Parsha Nasi already the day after the first day, what to us is the first day Shavuos, you see. So at that point, there's going to be a difference between Eretz Israel and between us until finally we get together again. We always have to get together when? The answer is, you have to get together during the 3 weeks. Because by tradition, Nasi would be the first of the Torah readings read during the 3 weeks, right? And, Matos would have to be, theoretically, Matos would be the first one, Masse would be the second, and then Devarim would be the third one prior to Tisha B'Av, okay? Naturally, what do we do? Almost always we read Matos and Masse together. So by the time that we reach Devarim, so then we're back again on the same key. Both there is Israel and us. So sometimes what they do is not to wait that long, but maybe with Chukas and Bonak, instead of reading it together as a double, so they read it as separate or something like that. Yeah. So that you have to take a look at the Luach. Thank God there is such a thing as a Luach, and at times we have to consult it. They used to call it the Luach HaKodesh, you know, the Holy Luach. Jewish life in Olmos is a sacred object for us, okay? All right, getting back to our text then. Okay, so we see that the first thing that the Mishnah stresses is that if the Megillah is to be read in a mixed-up order, then lo yetzoy, have not fulfilled the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. The Mishnah now continues and it says, Kira al-peh. Let's say if a person reads the Megillah by heart, without reading it from the text, right? Or Kira al-targum. Or let's say that he read the Megillah not in Hebrew, but he read it in the Aramaic translation. Okay? So, or becholoshen, or if he read it in any other language other than what? Other than the original Hebrew text. So it says, lo yatza. He did not fulfill. But now they're going to put in, yeah, but there's an exception. What is the exception? It says, avol korin osa lelo azos, belaz, okay? That we are permitted to read it in a foreign language to those who can only speak a foreign language. Okay? So far it looks good, right? In other words, it would mean what? That if we were to write the text of the Megillah on parchment, write the Book of Esther in an English translation, right? Write on parchment so that we can read the Megillah in English for the sake of people who do not understand it, right? That's what it seems. But we'll see that in reality, that's not what the halacha is. The one concession is something that we had earlier, one of the earlier dapim over here in the Gemara Megillah, where it says that what is the preferred non-Hebrew language? And the answer is it's Greek. Right.
It's what?
Greek.
Oh?
Yeah, because Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said that there is a beauty in the Greek language. And he quotes a pasuk taken from the book of Genesis, the story of Noah, where it says, Yav telekim the Yefes, right? That God will cause the beauty of Japheth, you know, the Yefes is the progenitor of the Greek people, among others, right? The Yishka Mohlek Shem, and it will dwell in the houses of Shem, and of course Shem is the progenitor of the Hebrew people. Okay, of course, others as well, but, you know, we are Shemites, right? Or Semites, okay? Descendants of Shem. So, because there's a pasuk, in other words, which speaks about the beauty of the Greek language, in accordance with the interpretation of Shimon ben Gamliel, then in that particular case, so they yielded on that and said that if a person were to write on parchment the Megillah in Greek, then it could be read to the Greek-speaking audience. Now, I don't have to tell you, we're not talking about modern Greek today, okay? They were talking about the ancient Greek people because, as we know, in Alexandria, for example, there was a tremendous Jewish community, and many of them did not know Hebrew. So for their benefit, this is why they made that concession. But as you can see, in Babylonia, what did they speak? They spoke Aramaic, right? And yet, what does the Mishnah say over here? Mishnah says, Kroa Targum, if he read it in the Aramaic translation, is Lo Yetza, right? So, from this we can understand now that in reality, they're trying to limit this business of reading it in any language other than in Hebrew, and confine it just to reading it in Hebrew. And then they continue over here, right? It says, Avol Korin or Selim was, the Halois. All right, that's the fourth line of the Mishnah, right? The Halois, Sheshema, Shuris. But if a person who speaks, he's not a Hebrew speaking person, right? But nevertheless, he hears the Megillah read in the Hebrew text by a Shuris over here. They don't mean Assyrian, but they mean, you know, the Hebrew text using the kind of printing that we have over here. And we had earlier, if you remember, you know, there was a discussion about the an older alphabet, you know, the one that what they call Ksav Das or Ratz or something like that. In other words, where they use an alphabet that we find, for example, upon some of the coins that they used to mint in Israel, okay? Where, like, for example, the kind of coins that were minted by Bar Kocha, where he used an old Semitic alphabet, okay? So, in that particular case, again, what does the Megillah have to be written in? It has to be written in the kind of script that we have over here. This is what I mean by Ashuris. So, if a person who does not understand Hebrew nevertheless heard the Megillah read in Hebrew, then in that particular case, Yotza, he has fulfilled the obligation of reading the Megillah. Of course, I don't have to tell you that it's good that when you hear the Megillah, you should understand also what it is, what you're reading. And for this, we have translations. And certainly, these days, it's become a common practice, you know, for many yeshivas to send out copies of the Megillah Esther in the Hebrew and the English, and please enclose a few bucks, you know, to support the yeshiva, right? It's more familiar. Yeah, of course, I mean, but I get it in English.
So you're saying that there's a minor exception that the Megillah can be not like the Torah, the Megillah can be written in Greek and read to a Greek-speaking audience.
Correct, right.
But otherwise than that, there's no...
No, and not only that, but if, let's say, if a person understands Hebrew, then in that case, he has not fulfilled his obligation by hearing it in a Greek translation. This is also understandable, okay?
Definitely. What does it mean, hearing, if the person doesn't understand? Reading can only follow the translation.
That's a good question, but you know that the word Shema in Hebrew has various translations. Shema means not only hear or listen, right, but it also means to understand something, okay? So we should make an attempt to understand also, you know, what it is that we are listening to. And that's possible in the translation. Oh, look what we have. I don't know. This is practically untouched. Of course, it's milking.
I'm milking, so don't make it.
Okay. But for many of us, apparently, we've all had flashing before we came over here. Okay. So now the Mishnah continues. All right. Karal say Rugin. What happens if a person reads, let's say he reads a chapter or two, and then he stops, catches his breath, whatever it may be, and then he continues again, let's say a few minutes afterwards, and so on, and then he'll continue from there, and so on. In other words, that you read it, you know, not as one continuous reading, but if you pause a little bit in between. So the answer is, that yes, Yotza, you have fulfilled your obligation as long as what? As long as you read the entire text and you read it, as we already said, you know, from we read it in its proper order, we haven't mixed it up, etc., etc., then even if we pause in between, then you're Yotza, okay? So, of course, for this, I mean, you know, we see that there is a possibility that what? That, okay, if we read it in Hebrew, right, and then we pause a little bit, we have a red light, we have a green light, and so on, you know, went to Klap Hovenen, and so on, and so forth, and so on.
In the morning, we don't have it.
In the morning, we don't have it, right. In the morning, Baruch Hashem, I was able to read without a break, right, yeah. Okay, another possibility, a mislanding. What happens if a person is reading it and he's half asleep? So, if he's completely asleep, take a snitch, okay? But if he's half asleep, this is what they mean by misnomnim, then in that particular case, you would be, again, if what? If you heard the entire beginning, okay? As the Gemara will later explain, what do they mean by Mistamnim? So it says, it's Nim V'Lay Nim, Tir V'Lay Tir, Aramaic form. Nim, he's sleeping, and yet he's not asleep, right? Tir, he's awake, but at the same time, he's not awake. And then they give a further definition, you know. And what if, let's say, they ask him a question, and at first he's a little bit bewildered, but then he remembers how to answer. So, in that particular case, it shows us that he's not completely asleep, and therefore, in that case, if he heard the entire Megillah, even though he took a, you know, kachat adimel, as we say, in between, then in that particular case, he will be yosef, okay?
But that's kind of passive. You know what's going on, but don't ask us to do put too much into it.
But mitnah main refers to the reader, right? Am I correct?
Oh, please.
No?
If the reader is half asleep, please.
Well, it says Korah Sarukim.
Yeah, right.
Mitnah main. I mean, so it seems to be together.
Well, you take them together, but in reality,
there's a comma.
Make believe there's a comma there, okay?
A comma after asleep.
that's the cross. It's right. Right. Okay. Right. All right.
Okay, so the listener is.
Right.
Okay.
No, because don't forget, in this particular case, we have to say that the reader and the listener are both fulfilling the mitzvah. When you read the Megillah,